Pretty big at the terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern last night. Yeah, they liked that one. Oh boy, poor Obama. Well, anyhow, this is White Aryan Resistance, as usual, right here, Johnny on the Spot. Right here. You know, wonder where that Johnny on the Spot came from. I always like to know these things. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And that's where you send your donations for the show and any other projects that you'd like to contribute to. And then go up to resist.com and get a college education on the subject of race, environment, all kinds of things. So anyhow, here we go. It is February the 19th, 2015. And it is slightly cold here. Yeah, it's still zero. And when I walked outside, good thing, even with my gloves on, my hands were freezing. So that's the way it goes. And I had turned on the radio this morning in the bathroom, and I've got one of those loop-de-loops. You can tune in weak stations. You know, I don't know whether you've ever seen them, but they're really neat, and they don't cost that much. You can set that big loop behind your little radio and tune in these weak stations, and they come right on in real strong. Well, anyhow, I tuned in one there, and he was going along. He says, 10 below zero, and it was Minneapolis. Jeez, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Yeah. Well, let's cover a little bit on the subject of euphemisms this morning to get our show started out with the Church of What's Happening Now right here in Warsaw, Indiana, or near Warsaw, Indiana. Yeah. Okay, reading from the Holy Book of the Church of What's Happening Now. Euphemistic language turns up in many areas of American life in a variety of situations. Not all euphemisms are alike, but they have one thing in common. They obscure meaning rather than enhance it. They shade the truth, but they exist for various reasons. Sometimes they simply replace a word that makes people uncomfortable. For instance, the term white meat, dark meat, and drumstick came into use because in Victorian times people didn't like to mention certain body parts. No one at the dinner table really wanted to hear Uncle Herbert say, "Never mind the thighs, Margaret. Let me have one of those nice, juicy breasts." It would have made them uncomfortable. And at the same time, for the same reason, belly became stomach. But even stomach sounded too intimate, so they began to say tummy. It's actually a bit sad. I first became aware of euphemisms when I was 9 years old. I was in the living room with my mother and my aunt, Lil, when I mentioned that Lil had a mole on her face. My mother was quick to point out that Lil didn't have a mole, she had a beauty mark. That confused me even more. Looking at Lil, the beauty mark didn't seem to be working. And it confused me further because my Uncle John also had a brown thing on his face, and it was clearly not a beauty mark. And so on that day, I discovered that on some people, what appears to be moles were actually beauty marks. And as it turned out, they were the same people who have laugh lines looked a lot like crow's feet. By the way, that whole beauty mark scam worked so well that some women routinely began to use eyebrow pencils to apply fake beauty marks. A fake mole being something no self-respecting woman would ever think of giving herself. Somehow I can't imagine Elizabeth Taylor turning to Joan Crawford and saying, "Lend me your eyebrow pencil, Joanie, I'm going to make a fake mole on my face." By the way, it was only a few years after Aunt Lil's incident that I took comfort in the fact that some people apparently thought my ugly pimples were nothing more than minor skin blemishes. Another role euphemisms play is to simply put a better face on things, to dress up existing phrases that sound too negative. Non-profit became not-for-profit because non-profit sounded too much as though someone didn't know what they were doing. not-for-profit makes it clear that there was never any intention of making a profit in the first place. But some words that are euphemized aren't even vaguely negative. They're merely considered too ordinary. For that reason, many things that used to be free are now complimentary. Asking the hotel clerk if the newspapers are free makes you sound like a mooch. But are the newspapers complimentary? Allows you to retain some small bit of dignity. This is the reason some hotels offer their guests complimentary continental breakfasts, while others give their customers free donuts. If you're one who would enjoy a closer look at euphemism, you'll find a number of sections in the book that will interest you. I broke the euphemisms into segments because they play much large and varied role in American speech. And I call it the new language because it's certainly new to me. I know I didn't grow up with it, and that's my larger point, that it's gotten worse over time. There were probably a few early signs I noticed, but I knew the problem was getting serious when I began to hear ordinary people refer to ideas as concepts. More to come. Oh, okay, that's reading from the Holy Book of the Church of What's Happening Now. And we'll be doing that probably almost every day, because you need to know this stuff. Now let's see what the rest of the jerks out there are doing today. Well, here's an interesting item. Actually, it's a writer writing out of Cuba, but I don't think he's necessarily Cuban. As the U.S. imperialism loses its capacity to compete outside the military sphere, its foreign policy options shrink accordingly. Since the U.S. is superior to the rest of the world only in military terms, Washington finds its ultimate advantage in turning the whole world into a battlefield. Permanent war follows the same logic as a death cult. In fact, one created the other literally. President Obama is a master of military supply and demand. His operatives and allies supply jihadists with enough weapons, financing, and in the case of Libya, a Euro-American Air Force to plunge vast tracts of Africa and Asia into bloody chaos, thus creating a demand for intervention by the planet's only indispensable nation, the United States. It is a diabolical formula for fomenting hell on earth, driven by simple logic. Since the U.S. is superior to the rest of the world only in military terms, Washington finds its ultimate advantage in turning the whole world into a battlefield. U.S. imperialism in terminal decay sees no salvation except through global war. What did I tell you, boys and girls, about it eating its own tail? Of necessity, Obama is a flamethrower, a fire spitter, a pyromaniac on a mission to incinerate humanity's capacity to resist. A vision shared by the jihadist death cults America has incubated for the past four decades. ISIS, the Islamic State begat by Al-Qaeda, which was begot by Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and the U.S. in Afghanistan, now declares sovereignty over portions of Libya, having occupied much of Syria and Iraq and planted the black flag in southern Yemen and the suburbs of Paris, where its token presence is enough to drive millions of Europeans into a decrepit crusader palsy. A subcontinent of thieves who have plundered the planet for half a millennium vow to send the dark others back to their own countries, as if Europe had not stolen these African and Asian homelands long ago through colonization, which was a bad mistake by the white race. In the end, however, what Europe will send is more weapons to the jihadists, mimicking the United States. This week, as happens every year, France, Britain, Italy, and other piratical European states joined the U.S. Africa Command's military flintlock exercise, designed to deepen African military's dependence on Western weaponry, training, and finance. Chad, a client state of both Washington and Paris, is the nominal host of the exercise, as if any of the African participants could actually say no to an imperial proposal. The flintlock maneuvers have converged with a regional military offensive against Boko Haram, the northern Nigerian jihadists that have gained so much ground since the U.S. and NATO turned Libya over to the tender mercies of Arab jihadists. That was in 2011. Libyan weapons flooded south across the Sahara Desert, bringing instability to the vast Sahel region, which is like honey to the Pentagon bee. The U.S. military has announced that it will share communications equipment and intelligence with the five nations preparing to battle Boko Haram around oil-rich Lake Chad. Imperial doublespeak for putting the Americans in charge of the command and control mechanisms of the armies of Chad, Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Benin. Boko Haram has proved quite useful to the consolidation of U.S. military dominance in West Africa. Meanwhile, the jihadist rampage has come full circle in Libya, where both ISIS and Al-Qaeda have multiple strongholds. Jihadist ultras are most deeply entrenched in Derna, a port city east of Benghazi, that accounted for the most jihadists killed and captured in Iraq during the American occupation. When the U.S. and NATO finally destroyed Muammar Gaddafi's forces after 7 months of bombing, hundreds of jihadists were sent to Syria, hoping to repeat the process against President Bashar al-Assad. Many have since returned to Libya, bringing the black flag of the Islamic State with them. Egyptian dictator Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, a supporter of one of the three rump governments in Libya, bombed ISIS targets in Derna after the decapitation of the 21 Egyptian Coptic Christian migrant workers. The atrocity, combined with the declaration of allegiance to ISIS by some Islamic rebels on Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, prompted el-Sisi to call for the U.S.-led coalition against ISIS to put Libya on its bombing list, an invitation from the world's most populous Arab nation for U.S. to extend the scope of its military operations to Egypt's western border. Jihad is truly a blessing for the U.S. imperial objectives. But there's nothing coincidental about it. The U.S. installed jihadists in power in Libya, leading directly to the destabilization of vast lands to the south, which in turn facilitated the U.S. African Command's mission to militarily dominate the continent. The U.S.-led jihadist proxy war against secular Syria was the incubator of ISIS, providing the U.S. with a new portal into Iraq, an excuse to operate openly in Syria, and now a possible chance to re-enter Libya, cloaked as a savior from the jihadist hordes that the U.S. armed, financed, and empowered only 4 years ago. ISIS has been such a boon to the U.S. war fomenting strategy. I've told you that quite a ways back, boys and girls. It's all smoke and mirrors. Obama has been emboldened to demand that Congress give him 3 years of virtual unlimited renewable powers to reboot the war on terror. Like George Bush before him, Obama refuses to put geographic limits on the scope of his crusade against ISIS and its associates. The world is his live fire chessboard. He can call the pieces whatever name he wants and make up the rules along the way. Every move is calculated to lead to greater militarization of relations among nations and people, because the military is America's strongest suit, in fact, its only suit. As I pointed out yesterday, the Federal Reserve is technically insolvent. The truth is, the rulers in the United States are as much a death cult as the Islamic State, although U.S. imperialism is infinitely more dangerous. Let us do our best to send them both to their respective paradises. That was written by a man by the name of Glenn Ford. I'm not sure whether he's white or black or what, but I thought it was a pretty good article. And this is why we all have to get out of the right wing, the conservative type struggle, because it's a false flag operation, has been for a long, long time. And they're going to always go along with the arms makers and so forth like that. And it's amazing to hear them cry about the infrastructure of the United States, and the Republicans talking about that quite a bit. But at the same time, they had put $750 billion into more armaments that we leave on the battlefield for people like ISIS to pick up and use. Insanity. But, you know, I was at a luncheon yesterday, and I heard grown people talking this Republican nonsense and not talking about all the deaths that were going on, and that's okay. And, they're protecting us, you know, from what? Yeah, and it was interesting. It makes you wonder what the hell is going on in these people's brains. I know nothing. Oh, yeah. Now, I see a headline here that's, I think, Israeli propaganda. Recent polls shows America's want nitwit Netanyahu to address Congress on the Iranian threat. They play that Iranian threat like they play a fiddle. I mean, who would they have to pick on if it wasn't Iran? The White House, many congressional Democrats, and even some Jewish groups have been pushing against Prime Minister Nitwit's upcoming address to Congress. Yet how much does their opposition reflect the views of the average Americans? According to a recent poll, numbers published in Bloomberg, they are not representative at all. More Americans support than oppose the speech, despite the controversy. Well, that only proves one thing. They're either lying or people are too stupid to know what's going on. The way they worked it is they, first of all, asked the people about the threat of Iran, and then they coupled with that, do you think it'd be okay, a good thing for Nitwit to address our Congress? So first they scare them, and then they get the answer they want. So 40-some percent said, oh, yes, I want to hear Nitwit. Nitwit, come here. Well, I don't know whether you saw the fact that the Islamic State threatens to send 500,000 Libyan migrants to Europe as psychological attack against the West. Well, that's right out of the book Camp of the Saints. Yeah. That might be a good thing, because then the whites of Europe would have to militarily organize for sure, whether their government liked it or not, if they saw 500,000 Libyan so-called migrants on boats and maybe old ships, like in the book Camp of the Saints, coming towards Europe. So, in the long run, ISIS might be doing us a favor. But they're not going to do that because they don't have the ability to do that. Well, here's something that sort of goes along with what I've been telling you for some time about the mulattoes. Model Amber Rose recently said in a radio interview, I do not consider myself a black woman. Absolutely not. Biracial. I embrace everything that I am. I don't feel like I'm more of one thing than the other. You see? The foot is definitely in the door. An interesting comment. You embrace everything that you are, but single out that you are not black. If we abide by the rule that is the Father's bloodline that determines our race, then Amber Rose is correct. She is not black. She identifies with her father being white. That being noted, I come to the next logical question. Who cares? I'm reading from an article here. These are not necessarily my views. It seems that people who are mixed with black and anything seem to prefer the non-black side. Of course they do. We are basking in a time when blacks are overcoming political and social barriers. No, whites are allowing them to. Yet people like Amber Rose, Tiger Woods, and model Devon Abdullah make it a point to detach themselves from being black and promote, "I'm mixed," as if to say, "I'm anything other than black." The mentality seems to be, "I'm not black, I'm better than that, I'm mixed." Well, of course. Why did you think it would be any other way? That's been going on since the mulattoism first really got popular. They don't want to be black. So they want to be biracial. They want to be lighter. They want to have straight hair. All that kind of stuff. So it, nothing changes. Racism is racism. You know, the blacks got it and we got it, and that's the way it goes. Boy, the Israeli ambassador to Sweden got his ass kicked on a radio show over there by Helena Grohl. She started the interview by asking him what he thought about Nitwit's call for Jews to leave Europe. So he said, "I explained that Alaya is not my work here, neither before such tragedies took place in Paris and Copenhagen or after. My job is not to convince the Jew population to move to Israel." Then the next question, she said, the Swedish journalist asked the Israeli ambassador, "Do the Jews themselves have any responsibility in the growing anti-Semitism that we see now?" His response was, "I told her I reject this question completely." But she did not grab this chance to move on, Bachman said. She failed to grab this opportunity to retreat from my Jewish onslaught. Indeed, Grohl kept shooting, "Why?" when Bachman responded that there's no place for such a question to be asked. Well, of course you can't ask Jews embarrassing questions, you fool. As Grohl began talking over Bachman, asking him to tell me then, explore with me why is that question of Bachman, finally silenced her by putting the situation in terms that she would be better able to understand. He said, his voice becoming firmer and louder until Grohl finally stopped talking. Quote, "To ask the question of whether a woman contributes to being raped is irrelevant to get altogether. I don't think there is a provocation that Jews are doing anything. Jews just exist. They don't do anything bad." Well, there we go. You can't ask these people embarrassing questions. How many times have I had to tell you? They're God's chosen pimples. Yeah. Okay. That's enough. We'll move away from Sweden for a while. But Helena Grohl, the interviewer on that radio show, better pack it in because she won't have a job. Well, let's get into the book, A Man Called Lucy, here, along with a lot of other ideas about the world wars that hardly anybody knows about. And that's interesting. The reasons nobody, or very few people, know about it is what's interesting, and why it's been hidden away. greater than Sorge, greater than Cicero. These are only some of the cryptic claims made by the late Rudolf Roessler, a man called Lucy. Alan Dulles, in The Craft of Intelligence, remarks, quote, the Soviets developed a fantastic source located in Switzerland, a certain Rudolf Roessler, codenamed Lucy, by means which have not been ascertained to this day. Roessler in Switzerland was able to get the intelligence from the German High Command in Berlin on a continuous basis, often less than 24 hours after its daily decisions concerning the Eastern Front were made, unquote. And Roessler was able to get the telex communications from the Third Reich. And only a few people in the party had access to those telexes. Alexander Foote himself, a member of the Lucy Ring, says in his book, Handbook for Spies, Lucy held in his hands the threads that led to the three high commands of the German forces. The effect of his communications on the strategy of the Red Army and on the defeat of the Wehrmacht was incalculable. Ron Seth, a British intelligence agent, says in his book, Unmasked, Rudolf Roessler must be ranked among the great spies of all time. Even in a review of our own book, in the French edition, under the heading Greater Than Sorge, the London Times Literary Supplement remarks, of all the espionage networks active during the Second World War, the one which has received the most respectful admiration from the professionals is the one operated from Lucerne, Switzerland, between 1939 and 1943 by Rudolf Roessler, codenamed Lucy. Neither Sorge nor Cicero, to quote the best-known examples, can match his achievements, unquote. Who was this man called Lucy? Why, despite these fragmentary references, is it so little known about him? How did we happen to pick up his trail? Like almost everything involved with this mysterious man, his tracks were well hidden. We stumbled across him almost by accident. And what we have attempted here is the first complete presentation of the greatest untold espionage story in World War II. It is strange when a book changes subject in midstream, but this is what happened to ours. When we set off to write it, our subject was to be Switzerland, 39 to 45. Hundreds of volumes had been published about the Second World War, but we were particularly struck by one gap. Very little seemed to have been written by the neutral countries, yet they too, in their own way, lived through the war. Their war did not take place on the battlefield, but in secret, through diplomatic pressure, unofficial agreements, and exchanges of information. Of all the European neutrals, Spain, Portugal, Sweden, and Switzerland, it seemed to us that Switzerland offered the most interesting field for study. How had the 5 years of war affected that country? How did the Swiss feed and clothe themselves? What had been their economic and defense policies, their relations with the French resistance and the Germans? These were some of the problems with which we were concerned. Now they are no more than background to the book that we have in fact written. As it now stands, and because Rudolf Roessler, this is a story of espionage and resistance. When we first came across this aspect of our material on Switzerland, our reaction was to put it aside. No, we were not going to end up writing another spy story. Naturally, we assumed that the Swiss Confederation, a neutral country surrounded on all sides by the Axis, but maintaining relations with the Allies, must have been a prime battlefield for spies of every nationality. We knew that this tiny area contained more German agents per square yard than any other part of Europe. But who would have dreamed that Switzerland, jeopardizing her neutrality, would permit one of the most astounding anti-Nazi espionage networks of the war to operate on their territory. Yet the discovery would not leave us alone. It led us irresistibly from the frontiers of the Swiss Confederation to the heart of the German and Soviet high commands. Almost invariably, whenever we broached the subject of Roessler, we were met with evasiveness, silence, sometimes hostile refusal, and we knew we had run into the heart of the mystery surrounding the man called Luzi. For the deeper we dug, the more we began to sense that Roessler had not remained one of the most enigmatic figures of World War II purely by chance. History seemed to have conspired to keep him obscure. In short, those best qualified to vouch for his invaluable contributions dared not admit that they had any part of Roessler. Switzerland, for example, determined at all costs to protect her neutrality with the Swiss even after the war, announced to the world that they had sheltered a master spy on their home grounds, permitting him to conduct his operations in return for first look at his reports. Would Stalin, who gained so much vital information from Roessler, be willing to acknowledge his vaunted reputation for military strategy stemmed largely from the communiques of an obscure German émigré? On the other hand, Germany was and still appears to be equally protective about revealing a leak in the very heart of the high command, a conspiracy of anti-Nazi traitors who were siphoned off top secrets and feeding them directly to the enemy. This conspiracy of silence obtains even with the Allied governments involved. The British, who once Hitler contained on the Russian front, received the brunt of Lucy's reports, claimed to have placed little value on them. Then why did a British general declare about Roessler's death that the man was worth a dozen atom bombs? What of the Americans? Official silence on Lucy? Alan Dulles, in his new book, The Secret Surrender, states, quote, "What went on between Swiss Brigadier Colonel Roger Mason, head of the Swiss intelligence, and SS Brigadier Walter, Walter Schellenberg, head of the Nazi Secret Service, who both played such a part in the Roessler affair, I do not know to this day." You know, I have a lot of regard for Schellenberg, who took over after Canaris, took over after, I forget his name, but anyhow, that was assassinated. Because he was within hours or maybe a few days of rooting out the spies in the Third Reich in the German high command. He was an excellent detective. Head of the Nazi Secret Service, who both played such a part in the Roessler affair, I do not know to this day. Yet of a forthcoming official German history of World War II, the London Sunday Telegraph remarks that the volume dealing with German opposition in general and Roessler in particular, quote, will no doubt be studied closely with interest by the British Secret Service and the surviving members of the American Office of Strategic Services. Then there is the matter of Roessler's behavior, which was most unorthodox for the average spy. Roessler was willing to supply his information on one condition, that the identity of his sources remain secret. As a result, for a long time his intelligence was discounted. How could it be assessed without knowing who was supplying it? Where is it coming from? Only after repeated attempts and long series of rebuffs did he manage to establish the value of his contacts. And he achieved only because of his uncanny accuracy of his information. Even then, his motivation was suspect. Some chalked him off as an agent provocateur, others as a German plant, still others as a Russian spy. Paul Carroll states that Stalin, prior to the German invasion, considered him a Western plant. Everything, in other words, but the one theory that satisfied all the facts and fitted the pieces together, and which we think is one of the most important disclosures of our book, that Roessler was simply and clearly a deeply dedicated Jewish anti-Nazi. In short, this man who posed as a Swiss bookseller and publisher was the spiritual conscience of the 10 top German generals dedicated to Hitler's destruction, who used Roessler as an instrument for transmitting secret intelligence directly to the Allies, and what secrets they were. A continuous flood of dispatches poured forth steadily from Roessler for over 4 years. Dispatches that totaled 12,000 type pages, the equivalent of 40 average-sized books. Here are only some of the high-level disclosures attributed to Lucy: the demilitarization of the Rhineland, the seizure of Austria, the invasion of Poland, participating in World War II, the first hint of the Nazis' final solution for the Jews, the invasion of Holland, the invasion of Belgium, the invasions of northeastern France and Luxembourg, the invasions of Denmark, the invasion of Norway, the first mention of the V-1 and V-2 rockets, progress reports on German jet plane development, and transcending toward even those astonishing revelations, advance warnings and complete battle plans of Operation Barbarossa, the attack on Russia, Hitler's second front attack on his former ally Russia. All this was followed by almost daily communiques giving detailed military operations, breakdowns of men and material. Often the Russians were provided with German plans in less than 12 hours. In one deal, the German commander overran Russian position and found a copy of his own attack orders. Colonel Frederick Hasbach, staff officer and Wehrmacht delegate to Hitler from 34 to 38, had spoken to Zweischen, Wehrmacht, and Hitler of those who had betrayed the secrets concerning military operations and sabotaged our military strength. Paul Carroll noted in Operation Barbarossa, Hitler's secrets were strewn all over the Kremlin table. Berlin was naturally bowled over to learn how accurately the Soviet agent in Switzerland was informing Moscow, and the Germans tried to discover the source. Who could have been so up to date concerning the plans of the German high command and become familiar with them within a day or so? The Nazis never found out, and even today, no one knows. Roessler went to his grave without revealing the names of his sources to anyone, neither to the Swiss, the Russians, nor the other so-called Allied powers. Schellenberg, assigned by Heydrich to track them down, had been obsessed by the question of their identities. And more than 20 years later, he found ourselves in the same position. We began very simply by going to the Swiss embassy in Paris, where we explained our mission to the cultural attaché, Mr. Bischoff, an obliging man who agreed to obtain the necessary introductions for us in Switzerland. From that moment on, our inquiry in Switzerland was conducted on two levels. First, we interviewed Swiss businessmen, journalists, officials who had survived the war. Second, we sought out the key man, who had interested Schellenberg, Brigadier Colonel Roger Mason, wartime head of Swiss intelligence, with whom Mr. Bischoff had put us in touch with through the air attaché at the Swiss embassy in Paris. 70 years of age, affable and cordial, Mason told us what he had told Schellenberg. Nothing. It was about 8 months before we realized that although he talked freely and at great length about his wartime service, Each time we touched on Rudolf Rösler, Maison entirely evaded our questions. But, and this proved to be enough, one day when he had a bit too much wine, he did reveal that the head of the spy ring in Berlin was a general in charge of transportation. By closely studying the organizational charts of the Oberkommando of the Wehrmacht, we were able to give this general a name. In the meantime, having determined that Rösler affair was obviously of enormous importance, and that the Swiss, like the Allies, were suspiciously reticent on the subject, we were resolved to alter our method of investigation, to abandon the Swiss officials and attempt to arrive at the truth about Rudolf Rösler by other means. We then got in touch with highly placed members of the French Secret Service, who had lived through the war in the resistance or in espionage, and who knew a great deal about Rösler affair. Contacts like these were extraordinarily difficult to establish, and it was only due to the backing of the office of the President of the French Republic, where we had close colleagues, that we made them at all. When we proposed the German general's name, they indeed confirmed our guess. Our techniques with our contacts in the British Secret Service, with whom we also had good relations, was identical. They never volunteered information, only replied to our questions. Often we had to wait weeks, sometimes months, before getting satisfaction on a particular point. But by and large, they did not evade us. It was thanks to these contacts that we were able to identify beyond any doubt the 10 traitors, a spy ring at the heart of the OKW in Berlin. So secret that it had managed to survive all of Hitler's successive purges, including the wholesale reprisals taken after the unmasking of the July plot of 1944. Parallel to our interviews with the secret services, we had direct contact with surviving members of the Lucy Ring. The Swiss officials were not helpful, and it was only by checking and cross-checking information that we succeeded in obtaining their addresses. At our first meeting, Rösler's colleagues, who still operate his publishing house, the Vita Nova Verlag in Lucerne, were very wary. Joseph Stocker, manager of the Vita Nova bookshop, was visibly distraught when he learned that we intended to write a book about Rösler. "Who are you? What are your credentials?" he demanded. "Rudolf Rösler was a saint. Do you hear? A saint. After the war, we were besieged by representatives of the Secret Service of every country. We've had enough." When he discovered that we were only journalists working for a publishing house and sympathetic to Rösler, he grew calmer and telephoned Xavier Schneiper, one of Rösler's close friends during the war. Schneiper set up the first of many meetings we had with him. It was he who led us to Rösler's grave and provided in the months that followed the principal facts on the Lucy Ring's method of operation. However, unaware that we had already learned their identities, he told us that Rösler had entrusted the names of his sources in Berlin to only one person, his son, who had been killed 2 years earlier in an automobile accident. Later we met Tamara Dubendorfer and her husband, Jean-Louis Bézier, one of France's greatest living mathematicians. Tamara is the daughter of Rachel Dubendorfer, who with Alexander Ratto and Paul Botchner was a member of the Communist Intelligence Ring, to which Rösler turned when he desperately needed a means of sending vital intelligence out of Switzerland to Moscow. Though Tamara, who now lives in Paris and has broken with the party, we learned that her mother and Botchner are today living in Leipzig, where Botchner is editor-in-chief of the Leipziger Zeitung, and Rachel is mentally disturbed, perhaps even insane. We also interviewed Edmund Hamel, one of the three radio operators who transmitted to Moscow the intelligence from Rösler that Ratto gave him after having it coded by Rachel Dubendorfer. Today, Heimel has a radio shop in the Rue des Courage in Geneva. He told us that during the most important campaigns of the war in the East, he often broadcasted for entire nights, from midnight to 8 a.m. in the morning. Heimel is a voluble little man who lives entirely in his past, without ever having understood precisely what it was he was broadcasting, or exactly how vital it was to the Russian victory in the East. Finally, we located Roessler's wife, Olga, living in Augsburg with her sister, who ironically enough is married to a former Nazi. Ms. Roessler lives in a wretched circumstances since the German government gave her no reparation for the destruction of their home at Tempelhof near Berlin. She is sustained only by the memory of her husband. An immensely cultivated woman, she has had to endure a good deal of unpleasantness at the hands of the local merchants. Here is the wife of the traitor. Since the publication of our book, of all the hundreds of people we interviewed on the trail of the man called Lucy, Olga Roessler was understandably enough the most reserved. Supplied with all this information enabled us to reconstruct the activities of the Lucy Ring in great detail. We got in touch once more with the Brigadier Colonel Messon. This time we explained the full scope of our book. Now he immediately understood that the wartime role of his country, as portrayed in our book, was to be different from its official version. Messon abruptly closed his files and announced he had nothing further to tell us. Confirmation of the Swiss government's official position was quickly forthcoming. The day after our final interview with Messon, we telephoned Colonel Rosset, chief of the Surat of Canton of Vaud, who was during the war an important member of the counter-espionage service. Quote, "I know your scheme," he told us, "and I have nothing to say to you. I understand that you met yesterday with Brigadier Colonel Messon, but I tell you today that the Swiss authorities will no longer cooperate with you." In fact, they did continue to cooperate, but they kept us under close surveillance on each of our many trips into Switzerland. Strange solicitude. They even investigated our private lives to see if they could find any pretext whatsoever to prevent us from entering Swiss territory. As a high official in the Swiss police told one of our colleagues who inquired about the official attitude towards us, no, you can tell your friends that they can always come to Switzerland. They are always welcome. Besides, we have found nothing with which to charge them. They pay their taxes, they have never been in prison, and they are not homosexuals. Our investigations concluded that the activities of Lucy Ring fully revealed at last. We realized that we could not disclose the names of Roessler's sources to the public. Germany lost millions of soldiers on the Eastern Front, and vengeance-crazed men are still to be feared. Nothing could happen to the officers themselves, for all of them are dead, but their families might conceivably be in serious danger. Today we are more than glad we observed such prudence. Shortly after the publication of our book in France, a furor broke out in Germany. The neo-Nazi party, whose success in the last elections in Hamburg and Bavaria surprised political observers, had seized upon the affair, demanding that light be shed on it and the names of the traitors be revealed. A journalist from Die Welt was already named several who he thinks belonged to that incredible plot, doubtless the only conspiracy that struggled against Nazism from the beginning of the conflict until the very end. And in the columns of the Times Literary Supplement, several months before our book was to be published in England, a spirited debate broke out concerning individual generals, even though we tried to disguise full names. It looks as though the explanation of Roessler's fantastic success is found at last, remarked the Times Literary Supplement, after our book did appear in England, although we devoted 2.5 years to intensive research, interviewed more than 150 people, some of them more than 10 times, and traveled more than 30,000 miles in our pursuit of the man called Lucy. It is also true that even we cannot deny the fantastic nature of some of our findings. How else would one describe the relentless cat-and-mouse game played by Schellenberg and Masson? Schellenberg happens to be someone I really had a high respect for. I talked about him years ago a lot when we first found this book. Schellenberg was young, he was smart, and he was an excellent investigator. He's the one who was able to cause two or three British agents to cross the, thinking they were crossing the Swiss border, and the Nazis were waiting on them, arrested them, because it wasn't the Swiss border. It was a total set-up deal to catch these British agents. That was Schellenberg. It's a famous story. How else would one describe the relentless... Oh, let's see here. The sophisticated triangulation and radio geometric devices used by the Germans and by the Swiss to pinpoint the transmitting stations of the Lucy Ring, known in Switzerland as the Viking Line. The day Lucy's code was broken because a German expert happened to remember the name of the hero in one of Jack London's novels. That's interesting. Rossler's staggering Christmas present to Stalin, one of the greatest intelligence coups in history. The complete plans of Operation Barbarossa, only 9 copies of which were in existence in the world. A present that took Rossler's network over 12 hours to decode and 48 hours to transmit. Schellenberg's diabolical plan to mount a full-scale invasion of Switzerland. Just to confirm the reality of Rossler. Well, I believe he was correct. They should have invaded Switzerland. They should have taken Switzerland because Switzerland was not neutral. There was all kinds of evidence to their not being neutral. And if they could have got Rossler early on, it would have changed the whole course of the war, probably the most important thing that could have happened in World War II. And the pathetic ending to the career of probably the world's greatest spy, captured and jailed in post-war years for leaking intelligence available to anyone in an ordinary bookstore. Over the years, bits and pieces of the fantastic jigsaw puzzle of Rudolf Rossler have cropped up. But now, for the first time, we have assembled all the pieces in a single book. Here, as best we can, we have attempted to present in some semblance of coercion and continuity, the logical chain of events that led this obscure political journalist and World War I officer into a role of master spy of World War II. Gathering these facts was a major effort. Rarely has a man's life been so surrounded with obscurity and contradiction. Disagreements still arise over such commonplace facts as his birthplace and religion, some news reports describing him as Catholic, as with so many other key figures in history who have either died or vanished. Rossler himself is dead. He died in Switzerland in 1958, too impoverished to have made provision for his funeral, the cost of which had to be borne by an anonymous donor. Schellenberg and Gusen are dead. Rado, chief of Russian intelligence in Switzerland, now lives behind the Iron Curtain, although many newspaper accounts have reported him executed. Foote, who was written about what he knows of Rossler, he met him in person only once, lived in England, where he was variously reported working for British intelligence and living the life of a simple clerk until his death, 1958. The story we were finally able to track down was so complex, it ranged over such broad sweep of time and geography that to give it the greatest possible unity, we have presented it almost as a narrative, even colloquially in many instances, while always careful to adhering to the facts as we know them. Only in this way, we felt, could we incorporate all our research, all the important side issues that cast vital new light on this fantastic story. This, then, is our reconstruction of the man who was described by a British general as having contributed more to our victory in Europe than could have been a dozen atom bombs, a man who may have cost Hitler World War II, certainly and unquestionably one of the master spies of all time, Rudolf Rössler, a man called Lucy. Well, I say it is the greatest, I mean, the biggest thing that happened to defeat Germany, because it had to do with the whole Russian front and the whole Russian operation. And that to me was the biggest plank, even though there was some other really bad mistakes made. Dunkirk was a horrible mistake. And also Hitler's involving himself in this being shot up with meth. In other words, he was a drug addict, whether you like it or not. Dr. Morell was shooting him up with the meth, and probably led to his paranoia, which he was sort of paranoid. And let's see, what else? There were some other things, but we'll continue this book. I think it's one of the most important books of the World War II era that there is. And you don't hear it from any of these Johnny-come-lately people. Even some of the Johnny-come-early people never wanted to touch this book. I've never heard anybody go through this book. Now, there may have been some, but I never heard it. Have you ever heard of any of these right-wing racial groups talking about it? They might have said something about me talking about it, but they don't talk about it. Now, this is extremely important information. This is perhaps, it gives you the answers to all the questions you've had about what the hell was going on the Eastern Front and so forth. Well, now you know that Germany was fighting, no matter how good they were fighting with one arm tied behind them, perhaps two arms tied behind them. You know? I think there's still copies of this book available around. It's hardbound, but I think Amazon and eBay and A-Books, some of these people have it, I think. And I don't think if you can find it, it's too expensive. It'd be good to have when you talk to your buddies and other people. And remember, in talking about Hitler being drugged up most of the time, he wasn't drugged up any more than John F. Kennedy. Of course, the man called Dr. Happy, Dr. Feelgood, shows how this Jew, who had worked before in Germany and had probably handed off his concoctions to Morell, and then Morell started shooting up Hitler. So he comes to the United States and he's shooting up John F. Kennedy during the missile crisis that really he'd created by refusing to pull the missiles out of Turkey, was high on meth. He was high on meth half the time. In fact, he couldn't operate without from time to time being injected. His wife was a meth user too, and along with all these Hollywood people that were into the meth. So it's a wonder we didn't blow our asses up with atomic bombs during that period of time. And all the time we were taught that Khrushchev was the horrible guy, and he wasn't at all. He simply wanted Kennedy to pull the missiles out of Turkey. They're right across the water from him. And when Kennedy and maybe whoever was before him refused, he talked Castro into taking those missiles down into Cuba to just let the United States know that if they weren't going to pull the missiles out of Turkey, he's going to put them in 90 miles from our coast, you know? And we're doing the same thing now by pushing NATO right up against Russia's borders with the missiles that they're going to have with them. Same thing all over again. Same thing. So who are the more warmongers in this thing? Who are the warmongers? Well, it's obvious who the warmongers are. It's the people behind NATO and the EU and all of that. They just keep pushing, like happened down through history, and finally somebody slaps them down, and playing Russian roulette with Russia is a big mistake. But the media and the State Department in this country has the whole population by the balls, by their brains balls. I mean, you ask the average Republican around any time and they're going to say, oh yeah, those horrible Russians and we should do something. We should invade them. All those horrible ragheads, we should invade them. All those horrible, oh, Gaddafi, get rid of him. Get rid of them all. Get rid of them all. We want regime change. So who is the most dangerous, if you will, satanic center in the whole world? It's right here in Washington, D.C. And history will bring it out every time. Sometimes you don't even have to wait for history. I mean, it's bad. It is bad. And the only reason we got a middle class in this country, or had a middle class, was because we bombed the shit out of all these other countries. We destroyed their infrastructure. And then we sit back and say, aren't we great? We built it with our own muscle and might. We built a middle class. Bullshit. It fell into your lap because your warmongers before blew the shit out of all the other countries. Well, if I haven't offended you today, check in tomorrow and I'll try harder and tell all these right-wing phony bastards and conservatives what I've said and let them hear this stuff. And if they don't like it, they can kiss my white ass.
You have a steadiness about you, and I believe in you, but it comes soon, and you must be smarter than your enemy. What are you trying to say? The Americans, they're very smart, but sometimes they can be incredibly stupid. They spend all this money, time, and energy on the so-called war on terror. They put satellites up in space. They can ram a smart bomb up a camel's ass from a situation room 5,000 miles away. But every time the U.S. kills an Al-Qaeda leader, what happens? There's a new one before the body's cold. You do it a million times. They never get it because the real solution always eludes them. That is, do nothing. Shut down a fundamentally flawed system. All you gotta do is step out of its way and it'll shut itself down. Nature has a way of correcting itself.